today on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Healing has become so wrapped up in capitalism and in consumer culture that it gets quite tangled, right? Because, of course, anything that gets captured by the profit motive becomes self-perpetuating. So there's never enough healing in that sense, right? For me personally, I'm quite Jungian in my outlook. So I would say that healing is when we reach a sense of wholeness and coherence between the part of ourself that is cut off from the deeper essence of who we are. I don't like using the word ego because I think it's also just completely wrapped up in tangles. But let's just say the egoic self, I think a large part of healing comes from that recontextualizing itself into a deeper ground of the self, which is this kind of emergent essence of who we are. And for me, that is healing. And so it's really a process of coming to wholeness.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. Together, we'll explore the transformative power of psychedelics, diving deep with researchers, healers, and trailblazers who are shaping the future of this field. This journey is supported by two visionary enterprises that share our commitment to ethical and inclusive healing. First, we have Holos Global, a pioneer in holistic living communities. Nestled in Costa Rica's serene Diamante Valley, their flagship retreat center is a beacon for those seeking therapeutic experiences with plant medicine, all within a licensed alternative health clinic. We are also supported by Hurricane Lotus, a groundbreaking infrastructure as service and credit lending platform specifically tailored for the pioneers of psilocybin and ibogaine. Their innovative technology and financial solutions are setting new standards in accessibility, safety, and compliance, driving forward the legal psychedelic service industry. And for those of you who hunger for more conversation about growth and transformation, join me on my personal podcast, Life is a Festival. Now, without further ado, let's welcome today's guest. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. And I do mean welcome back. We've been on a year and a half hiatus. It's no secret that the psychedelic renaissance slowed down a bit recently. This affected big listed companies and small, humble podcasts. But I'm grateful to say we are back and releasing regular episodes thanks to our new sponsors, Hurricane Lotus, formerly Maya, who was the original sponsor of this show, and Holos Global. Today on the show, I'm speaking with Alexander Beiner, author of The Bigger Picture, How Psychedelics Can Help Us Make Sense of the World. On the show, we discuss the roots of the mental health crisis, the role of psychedelics in healing, what healing actually is, according to Beiner, understanding existential risks and how that relates to psychedelic healing, and ethical dilemmas in psychedelic healing. We close our conversation with Alexander's extended state DMT experience at Imperial College London and his belief in the power of the teaching presence. Now, here's Alexander Beiner. Alexander Beiner. Allie is good?
Allie is good, yeah.
Allie, great. Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
It's very good to be here. Thank you.
We are returning from a year-long hiatus, and considering your new book, I felt like you were an excellent person to speak to psychedelic practitioners and healers as we are on the cusp of 2024 and a lot has changed in this space. I felt like you were an excellent person to talk to, largely because while Michael Pollan's book is about healing the individual, your book is taking it a step further and it's about healing society. And I believe, and I think many of our listeners would agree with me, that when people are interested in psychedelic healing, supporting and facilitating psychedelic healing, we're really looking at societal healing, right, at this point. Like, we can't separate it into individual healing. I think there's a general understanding that you just can't keep all the systems the same and give someone a psychedelic and then their neurochemistry is going to shift and all these maladies are going to shed. I feel like people generally have that perspective. And I felt like your book was really refreshingly cogent in arguing that case and talking about some of the pitfalls and things we should be aware of. And so for these reasons, I'm really excited to have you as our first guest after our year of taking a break.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words and glad the book resonated. And yeah, I'm excited to dive into this. We've chatted a couple of times in the past. And I've always really enjoyed it. And it's interesting you mentioned going into 2024. It just brings to mind for me where the psychedelic world is moving, or let's say the many places it's moving, because it's not a cohesive culture or unit. And so I think it's quite interesting to reflect on now as we've come through the boom of psychedelic capitalism that kind of began in 2020, and that's now halved. About half of the companies have gone under, which was to be expected, I think, in the sense that there was a lack of understanding about what these molecules and medicines really are and how they work. So my hope is, and what I feel hopeful about, is that there's a maturity coming into the field that is quite needed. So how does that maturity then grow and change in the future? I don't know, but I have my own hopes of how that might look and where I'll focus my energies at least.
And we'll talk in a moment about some of your qualifications for expressing ideas about this. We all have great ideas about psychedelics. Some of us have been instructed by entities that we are going to save the world, for example. But with you, you've been working in this space longer than I have, and you've had a lot of different touch points, and you've done a lot of work in personal growth generally. Like, there's a lot there, and we're going to excavate that a little bit. But as a starting point to kind of lay the table for our conversation today, I'm going to read from your book, The Bigger Picture. And this is something that I think our listeners will appreciate because it's exactly the sentiment that is why we're here. You write, psychedelics alone don't necessarily lead to transformation. Who would have thought? Change is brought about when psychedelics are taken in combination with a practice like therapy or religious ceremony. And you go on to say, the best chance we have of healing the mental health crisis is zooming out to look at the bigger picture and addressing it from the roots. So as a starting place, can you tell us about the roots of the mental health crisis as you see them?
Yeah, sure. So I'll caveat this by saying that this is a complex problem. So I'm only ever going to be able to, or any of us, grasp certain threads of it. So the first, the deepest root, in my view, is what John Vervaeke, who's a cognitive science professor at the University of Toronto, and I would say philosopher as well, he calls the meaning crisis. Right, so that this idea that in the West in particular, and specifically in consumer cultures that don't have a sense of a deeper, let's say, metaphysical layer or a sense that we are working towards a deeper purpose than just profit or just expansion or continuous progress, that leaves us with a cultural story which doesn't really give us a reason to live. You know, if the reason to live is to continuously grow and expand, Edward Abbey, the environmentalist and author, he said continuous growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. I think it was him who said that. And so that's a very interesting insight. It's not a sustainable model on which to base life. And so the roots of the meaning crisis go way, way deeper. And he, you know, Vervaeke has this great series called Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, which people can check out on YouTube. It's 50 hours long. I've only met a few people who've watched the entire thing, but I've watched a big chunk of it. The roots, I think, of that go, especially in this part of the world where I'm from, and let's say the Anglo-Saxon sphere and developed nations, as they're called, goes back to the Enlightenment, where we have this cultural story that tells us that the world is dead. Basically, the world is like a machine full of cogs, and it doesn't have an aliveness to it. And in fact, a neuroscientist would have that same perspective, which is that, no, your consciousness, like your experience right now of listening to this podcast, is not really a thing. Because the only thing that's really, it's a secondary quality of matter, of your brain, of your brain processes. So the real thing, what we've decided culturally is real, is stuff, things, quantity. And yet our whole experience of the world is qualitative, which means it's about what it's like to be you, right? The beingness, the essence of being alive. And so a cultural story that says, no, that second thing, the experience of being alive, is secondary to stuff. it makes a lot of sense why we would be consumerist in that story, because why not? Why not destroy the planet? Why not seek immediate gratification and forget about wisdom and virtue and values? So it's really no surprise that we have that kind of culture. And from that kind of culture, we have epidemic rates of loneliness, because there's a deep disconnection. There's a hyper-individualism, which means we're not connecting to one another. We have a massively declining rates of trust in institutions around the world. And we then also have obesity epidemics. We have a lot of signs of dis-ease in terms of what our lives, the type of lives we're living. Now, that's not to say that it's all bad, because it is miraculous as well that so many people have been lifted out of poverty in the systems we have. So I'm not really making the claim that we should go back to a kind of, I don't know, imagined utopia, or all go and live in communes and sing kumbaya, because I think it's a way more knotty problem than that. I think it's much more a case of we have to adapt to this world we've created. And then in that adaptation, reconnect to the body and reconnect to the sacred. And I think psychedelics can be a really powerful tool to do that if used in the right way.
This crisis that comes from a lack of connection to the sacred, this experience of amorphous choose your own adventure meaning that's based on a materialist kind of philosophy. I can see in my life how that has impacted me in terms of loneliness and depression. Depression has been an interesting response I've had to that. And I can see it. I can see at times in my life where I've been in service and community engaged versus times where I've been lonely and isolated, alienated, especially when I was younger. For you, have you felt the kiss of these modern maladies?
Yeah, certainly. I think my bigger struggle is with anxiety. That's something I've struggled with since I was a kid, really. And I think the anxiety, just as much as depression, is a kind of, let's say, a malady that affects so many of us, because as well as the culture being one of disconnection and increasingly connection mediated through technology, which can be valuable, but also lacks the sense of, like, a social media feed is not the same as a town hall, right? Where people have skin in the game and we're talking about a sense of values linked to place. It's this sort of amorphous collective unconscious where it actually brings out our worst qualities. So as well as that kind of disconnection, we also have a culture which, of course, is relies on continuous growth and progress. And of course, what governments talk about as success metrics is increases in the growth of the economy. So in that sense, there's a continuous pressure, I think, like a continuous anxiety to grow and do more, which I think I absolutely fall into that trap and struggle with quite a bit. So I think, yeah, I think it's those two aspects, the anxiety and the depression, I think are, yeah, I think it's something a lot of us struggle with.
You speak of psychedelics as a potential access point for changing some of these challenges, both in ourselves and in the world. Can you think back to a psychedelic experience you had earlier in your life where you had an awareness that the experience was healing, that the experience was offering some degree of perspective or transformation around some of the topics we're discussing around the loneliness and the disconnection? Do you have a memory of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would say most of my experiences are like that to some degree. One of the most salient aspects of the experience is this sense of deep connection with the world and with nature. You know, I can remember these experiences of deep intimacy with the world and what's sometimes called an embeddedness in the world. And that is really crucial, you know, so feeling that I am part of nature and nature is moving through me. One of the key aspects of the meaning crisis is this sense of not being at home in the world, right? Being placeless and being adrift. And I think culturally, that sense of being adrift, I do think that contributes significantly to mental health in quite a significant way. So there's something about feeling re-embedded in the world, and then also that the world and the universe is conscious. And this is, research shows that this attribution of agency to the world, so seeing the world as having a purpose, meaning intentionality, perspective of its own. There's a Johns Hopkins study from a couple of years ago that shows that very, very significantly people's sense of that increases with psychedelics, even down to objects, much more with trees and nature, and then even down to like coffee mugs. I can't remember the percentage, but like 20% of people or something were like, yep, that coffee mug is alive or real.
It's like a panpsychist. It's like a panpsychist perspective that consciousness innervates everything.
Exactly, panpsychism. So when I spoke to Michael Pollan for my book, I was surprised because he was saying, we were talking about that study. He was pointing out that animism is almost universal among humans, except for this particular society that we're in now. So animism, the idea that the world is animate, that it's got an aliveness to it. And he was saying, even if we don't actually believe that philosophically or scientifically, it would actually serve us to behave as if it is true. This is a point I make in the bigger picture in my book, which is that, you know, that fundamentally changes how we approach the world and one another. If nature is alive and we are all part of a vast, interconnected, living universe full of intention, that is fundamentally different to being in a dead, cold universe that doesn't care about anything. It just radically changes all of our values, all of what we would do. It's not a magic fix. It's not like we can all just suddenly become animists overnight and everything's going to be fixed. But it's the basis, or it's a basis from which to build deeper intimacy with the world. And so for me, all of my experiences in some way, you know, are about a deeper intimacy with myself, going to those places in myself which are hidden, embarrassing, dark, painful. And it's about then also doing that within the context of feeling deeply connected to to the source of love and care that holds us. You know, I think that is part of what makes the psychedelic experience so powerful for many people, is that there is a sense of being held and cared for by whatever the experience is, you might say, by the mushrooms or by God or by the universe.
By the spider queen.
By the spider queen, yeah, whatever it may be.
What does healing mean to you? We think a lot about this healing journey, this process. You've just described meeting our edges, shadow work, going to the places that are uncomfortable, and being with that discomfort in the context of a broader connectedness. Is that what healing is? Is there some process on our way to become more healed, or perhaps at some point healed?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because healing has become so wrapped up in capitalism and in consumer culture that it gets quite tangled, right? Because of course, anything that gets captured by the profit motive becomes self-perpetuating. So there's never enough healing in that sense, right? If you're looking at it in those terms. Or you get the sort of new ageism of like, you're perfect the way you are, which on perhaps a deep spiritual level, I agree with, but practically, I don't think anyone really believes that deep down, right? Because otherwise, why would we do anything? You know, it can become its own form of narcissism where it's like, oof, I don't have any responsibilities to anyone. I don't have to do anything. So it's all really tangled. But for me personally, I'm quite Jungian in my outlook. So I would say that healing is when we reach a sense of wholeness and coherence between the part of ourself that is cut off from the deeper essence of who we are. So, you know, the sort of, I don't like using the word ego because I think it's also just completely wrapped up in tangles. But let's just say the egoic self that feels both that it's separate from the world and that also it has agency and control across time, right? So it's like, oh, I can do with these things in the future and then I can control this and control that. I think a large part of healing comes from that recontextualizing itself into a deeper ground of the self, which is this kind of emergent essence of who we are, this sort of like effortless flowing beingness. And for me, that is healing. And so it's really a process of coming to wholeness. And that's what all our stories are about. Pretty much all the stories we tell are about a character going from being less and missing something and then going through a process of growth to become more. And then also crucially bring that back to the community, right? So it's really a process of communal, like healing cannot just be individual. And I say this as someone who is extremely individualist. I just am. It's just like how I was the environment I grew up in and my personality structure, my own process of development is learning how to connect more deeply and drop into intimacy with others. So I do, though, think that healing can only really be something that combines the individual and the collective together. Yeah, that's the kind of process it is, in my view.
You talk about bringing back to the community. I imagine that most people who are involved in what you might refer to as the healing arts on one side or psychedelic therapy on another side, I think many people believe that this is them bringing back to the community. And in our culture, everywhere really, there's this idea about securing your own oxygen mask before you help others, which is a lovely reference to a crashing plane. A moment ago, you spoke about, you know, it's not helpful to say I'm perfect just the way I am. Also, it's not helpful for us to get caught up in some sort of never-ending cul-de-sac of healing. Yeah. How healed does someone need to be supporting the healing of others?
Ooh, yeah, what a good question. Well, okay, my first question would be, what does it mean to be healed? The therapists who I did my training with and my counseling training, they point out that you're only really able to handle in another what you've handled in yourself, right? So if someone is coming with a particular personality tangle or behavior that is completely unresolved in yourself and is an unresolved shadow in yourself, it's going to be extremely difficult for you not to get into your own reaction around that. So in that sense, having done enough work that you feel confident that you can, at the very least, not let your unresolved shadows bleed out onto someone else, I think is quite important. And that is, for me as a facilitator, one of the absolute key things. That by no means that you don't means that you don't have shadows or that you're not doing work. And you know, when I facilitate groups, there's a constant process with the facilitation team of cleaning out and naming where's the transference and counter transference, what's really triggering you about a participant, what's yours, because it is yours that in that moment you have to be present for. So as long as you can do that and commit to that, I think you don't have to have this sense of being healed. I would say that in psychedelic work, what I think is absolutely essential, and in my opinion, a must-have, is extensive psychedelic experience. I don't think there's any shortcut to that. And I think unless you've had, I don't want to put a number on it, but I personally would not be interested in working with someone who hadn't had at least 20 psychedelic experiences and some kind of other training on top of it. You know, there's people doing this work who've had like 3 experiences and now they've done some facilitator training somewhere and they're like, oh yeah, I can hold this space. It is a skill like any other skill, and you have to have a sense of having been to those places yourself. You have to have been stuck. You have to have been terrified. You have to have been blissed out. You have to have been to those places so that when it shows up, you can be present with someone. Because if you haven't, you don't know what's going on. It's just a mystery.
So like many of our public intellectuals in this current cultural moment, you are quite concerned with existential risk. And indeed, you have spoken about psychedelics as a tool for meeting existential risk, a way of finding solutions to what is often referred to as a multipolar crisis. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But in general, that psychedelic healing, the way that psychedelics can heal communities, society, then actually this is a tool that we can use as a species to approach existential risks, climate change, AI, government instability, whatever it may be. Do you think it would be skillful, supportive, for those in psychedelic healing to also prioritize existential risk as part of why they're doing what they're doing and include it in their perspective of the work they're doing? Or do you feel like it's important for someone who is facilitating someone else's experience to be more focused on that person's personal biography, what they're personally working with?
I would say the latter, that people should focus on the actual work of that individual person and that space that they're in. And the reason I say that is because existential risk is a massive, overlapping, complex problem that none of us really fully understand. And this is something Daniel Schmachtenberger, who's kind of one of the main voices in this area of study, he points out that you have to be super careful with it because it's a very easy place to project all of our own expectations and ideas into, right? So you get this, for example, with there's a group called Deep Adaptation, which is created by a guy called Jem Bendel. He wrote a paper about, which I actually disagree with, from my opinion, looking to the sources he used and the way he approached it, using, it was called Deep Adaptation, I think, the paper. And it was basically like, it's all too late. We're all fucked. The world's going to end. All we can do is adapt. And so he does workshops, etc., where, I don't know if they still do, but certainly my experience of that group was one in which it becomes almost like a religious expression of end times. And it becomes a kind of way of expressing particularly like something that would normally get expressed through religion, but in a society that doesn't have religion, we tend to choose ideology over that. And so anything about death at the end of the world can very easily slip into that. So we have to be very careful with it. And I think it's kind of dangerous to bring that into a psychedelic space because we don't know what we don't know. And it's too much of a potentially negative primer. Now, it might be that comes up for someone in an experience and they are concerned about climate change or whatever it might be, and then that's worked with. But as facilitators, or pretty much any of us, in fact, all of us in the world, and I've spoken to some of the most brilliant people involved in existential risk, none of them know. None of them know what's going to happen in the future. None of them are able to predict. None of them have a solution for what we might do. So I think it would be hubristic to, as a facilitator or a healer or a therapist, to be bringing that in. Yeah, that's my take on it.
Is it helpful to have an awareness of these themes? So for example, you write and speak a lot about multipolar traps, and you talk about multipolar traps in the context of psychedelic capitalism. Now, I would argue that someone who is working in psychedelic healing should be aware of what's going on with psychedelic capitalism. That's an important thing to be aware of, even just for your own sort of commercial viability and awareness of how you should be pricing things and what equity and inclusion means. Those things are really important. So I was actually surprised by your answer. I'm not sure why I was surprised by your answer, but I like that you're like, let's keep it with the present moment because we could project some things that are unhelpful. I think that's a great answer. But do you feel that it is important for people working in this space to be up to snuff on this philosophically?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a different thing in my view, because it's about awareness and it's about understanding. So you could see healing work and therapy as very much focused on the internal state of the person. And in integral studies, there's this idea that that's a different domain of knowledge to understanding the external world and the way those systems work, right? And so Integral argues that you need to be able to hold both of those realities at once and both of those perspectives at once without using one to comment on the other. For example, if someone in a trip has a vision of, oh my God, there's going to be a flood, that we know, oh my God, there's going to be a flood in this country. No, that was a different kind of information. If we want to know if there's going to be a flood in the country, we have to look at the system, the environmental system, and all the different factors of that. So it's a different way of knowing, basically. And so I think certainly as a facilitator or a therapist, understanding the system in which you're working is crucial. And, you know, in a lot of therapy schools that use a systemic approach, that would be something that probably they're doing anyway as well. So in particular, something to understand the nature of the economic system we're functioning in, which tends to select for, you referred to it, multipolar traps. A simpler way of saying that is race to the bottom scenarios, where, for example, if anyone read We Will Call It Pala, which was a short story that came out a few years ago, they brilliantly explored this, where a woman opens a psychedelic healing center and for the absolute best intentions, she wants to heal, like most people go into this space with the best intentions, all of us do, almost. And so, but then what happens is other centers open and there's pressure on her economically to either cut corners. How about one integration session instead of three? How about maybe people could be dosed at home and you could do it over Zoom? Stuff like that is what the pressures of the environments for, because if you don't do it, somebody else is going to. That's the multipolar trap. If you don't do it, someone else will. And then that puts you in a very difficult position where you're like, well, I believe I could do it better and I'm more noble than them. And everyone just gets completely screwed over, right? And so what ends up happening is a race to the bottom, because the worst scenario ends up winning out because everyone is just cutting corners to meet the competition, until you get to a point where, without some kind of intervention by a third party, you know, where there's a government or an ethics body or something like that, there is no bottom to it. So it could end up in the most fantastical way. It could be like, okay, well, we're just going to send people LSD in the post and charge them $1,000. And that's going to be the psychedelic therapy, because it's too expensive to use therapists. And this other clinic started doing it, so we'll do that. So you get it. You get to a point where you have to make a choice between your own values and ethics and surviving in the system. And that happens. That's an extreme example, but that happens for everyone in the environments they're in. It happens for academics, because there's this, you have to publish or perish. So what the academic institution is putting pressure on people to do is publish as many papers as possible, quantity, right? But what academia should be is a pure pursuit of truth. And that might mean one paper that you write over 20 years, but it's fucking a banger of a paper and it really changes stuff. It means that that kind of thing doesn't happen, because the one person who wants to write this beautiful, sweeping paper over 20 years, they're going to lose their job, because the pressure of the system's like, yeah, that's great, but how many papers are you going to put out? So most of our institutions and systems within the current model we have are full of multipolar traps. And there's this concept called value capture, which I talk about in the book, which comes from a philosopher, C.T. Nguyen, whose name I really struggle to pronounce. And when I did the audiobook, I had to repeat many times. He has this great book about agency, about games, about how games are basically the art form that we use to explore agency. So painting is how we explore vision, and music's how we explore sound. And in his view, games are how we explore agency, which is our ability to act in the world. And it gives you different ways to explore that. It's like, hey, you're not you. You're a small, pudgy Italian plumber, and your whole world is just to save this princess. You're like, great, sweet. Okay, I can do that. I don't have to deal with all my complexity of my life right now. And then he points out that social media is a game. It's like Twitter is, okay, how do you win the game? Likes and retweets. How do you get likes and retweets? By posting controversial stuff. So you might have the value of, I want to go on Twitter, or X as it's now called, I want to go on X and have a really deep, honest, vulnerable conversation about gender, right? What's going to happen is the people who are playing the game that it wants to play win the game. And you're playing the game you want to play, but your values are going to be captured if you want to be successful on there. So that's just one example, but it's pretty much true in most workplaces and institutions that people find themselves in.
So we're going to try to be solution oriented in this moment, and to the best of our ability. And when I say we, I really mean you, my apologies. And to do so, I'm going to create an example for you, which very well could be one of our esteemed listeners. So imagine a person, let's put them in their mid to late 20s. They have done some trainings in psychedelic therapy. They're very passionate about it. They've felt healing in their transformative experiences, and they have decided that it makes sense for them to operate in what is colloquially referred to now as the gray market by many psychedelic proponents, which is not the underground. We call it the gray market, the thing that is not quite legal, but it's a space where many people are working. Let's say this person has done two trainings. They're good trainings. They feel equipped to hold space. And they have found that people are willing to pay them a fair amount of money to do this, and that they can actually do three of these experiences in a week and make $15,000. Their clientele are some wealthy, middle-aged, lost people who are willing to pay a lot for some space holding. So take this person as an example. They can make $15,000 a week, and they feel that they're helping healing. They're helping wealthy people who they believe will then help other people, because these people probably have more agency because they have more resources. And it seems like a fair and legitimate thing to do. First of all, is this a fair and legitimate thing to be doing? What are the potential problems with this? And how does this butt up against what you've been talking about as multipolar traps?
Yeah, interesting one. So I would say the first thing that comes to mind is, if you're working with very well-resourced people, let's say stockbrokers in New York, and you're doing that kind of work, and you're making your 15 grand a week, and you think that by them having that experience, they're going to then, there's going to be sort of like a Reagan era idea of like trickle-down consciousness in some way. I think that is very misguided, because really that doesn't happen in my view. It might happen occasionally, but it certainly doesn't happen unless someone actively goes into the experience with the intention of trying to transform their workplace or their relationships or whatever it might be. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't have a benefit. I think it can be really amazing. The insights people have can then, of course, affect their spheres of agency, the people around them. So it's not that it doesn't happen. It's just that it can be a very comforting idea to assuage guilt that, oh yeah, but these people who are in these positions of power are going to then, their ayahuasca experience or their psilocybin experience is then going to somehow expand out. I don't think there's really much evidence for that. I don't see that really happening. And I don't think it's much evidence for it, because what actually has to change is the system that they're part of, and the value, the embedded values of that system is the problem. So you could have the best willed stockbroker in the world, and they go in on Monday after their big, massive mystical experience, and they're like, guys, we should be only investing in ethical green companies. And his friends are like, what? Right? Even if they all got together and they were like, yeah, we're going to do it, their stockbroking firm, their clients would leave them and go somewhere else, right? Potentially, right? This is not to say this is not possible, that there aren't people who could then create new solutions in the systems they're in. That absolutely can happen. So I'm not trying to poo-poo the whole thing. I'm just saying it's extremely difficult without a lot more thought and a lot more focus. So there may well be someone who goes, you know what? I'm going to change this whole industry. And that happens, right? People do that. So that's great. And that can happen. So I'm not trying to say it doesn't happen, but I'm saying that it's very, very easy to think you're doing more work than you're doing. And psychedelics also tend to be inflationary of ego and inflationary of a sense of importance and deeper purpose, even for facilitators who might not actually be taking the psychedelics. So it's something we have to be really careful of. So that's one aspect of it. And ethically, what should people consider? I don't really know, in the sense that wealthy people have a right to take psychedelics, people have a right to offer them those experiences, in my view. It's really just a question of being creative with what people do. For example, what you could do is then offer those experiences to people who couldn't afford them, because that is a huge question right now, is around access, because it's really expensive. Psychedelic retreats are really expensive, and it's in part because all retreats are really expensive. Even if you just take people for 5 days to a reasonable venue that's not over the top, and you feed them for 5 days, that costs thousands of dollars just to do that. Imagine booking a hotel for 5 days, right? And then add all your food on top of it. And then you add on the facilitation and all the care and all the prep and integration. It's not easy to do without a price point of a few thousand dollars. So that immediately prices a whole bunch of people out. So one interesting area to look at is, how can you take some of the income that you're making and then bring it to people who could really use these experiences?
Yeah, the equity and access thing has been my little drum that I like to beat, which is basically the idea that if these molecules help us excel in certain ways, help us heal, help us be creative, and they are accessible to those who are well-resourced, then those who are well-resourced will become more well-resourced, and it'll just widen inequality. We started the conversation by talking about the need to change society and the need to heal society. If we are adventuring in psychedelics in a consumptive way, and we're on our own little individual healing journeys, and we're making money and we're catering to people who have money, to me, that misses the revolutionary potential of these molecules. And I like the idea of some kind of balanced thing where you're charging some people a certain amount so you can make space for others. I think that's a very potent way of looking at it. It came up for me just in the concept of these multipolar traps. And I feel like the wellness industry is similarly that way, where it's, I'm an influencer and I can make this much money if I do this thing. And so if I'm not influencing as hard as someone else, then they're going to be influencing harder. And this sort of, I really like the account Healing from Healing, which I think you're I imagine you're probably aware of. Yeah, Adam Stuff is so good. He's so smart. You know what I would say for me is just like, let's just keep checking ourselves. For the people listening, if you're in psychedelic therapy, is it, as you've just said, it's not wrong to offer these experiences, but let's keep doing our work. Let's keep checking ourselves. Maybe it's your mentor you talk to. Maybe you got to go check in with the spider queen and get rocked a little bit in your extended state DMT experience, which we're about to talk about because that's hilarious. But I think that there's a constant leaning towards impeccability that I think is necessary for people who really do wish to be the healers who are bringing the boon back to our communities.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say also just like it helps a lot to be honest and just aware that we are all trying, I think everyone is trying to, or most people are trying to be ethical in some way. Like you said, with the multipolar trap, the system does not allow for ethical behavior very well. Instagram doesn't really care how ethical you are. It cares how many views you get. So that means that we're all struggling in that. And so it also means that we have an opportunity to collectively be like, this system fucking sucks. And let's create something new, right? Let's build new types of tech. Let's have new approaches. Let's have some kind of system of accountability within the field. And so these things are all possible. It's just that they're tough. They're really tough. But so is psychedelic healing. So we're used to going into tough places and finding new solutions. So I do see hope in that. I think just like opening the conversation is also very important around that, because it's not that fun to hustle on social media. You know, I do it to sell my book, and I love my book and I want it to get out there. And I like the content I make too. I enjoy it, but I also feel this pressure of like, got to keep feeding the machine, do a new video, keep being creative. And I've obviously been in that space for some years, but it is fairly exhausting. And that's on me. I'm choosing to do that. But I also do recognize that we are kind of all feeding a machine.
And if only we were feeding machine elves instead. Like that for a segue. You like my transition?
Amen. That was a wonderful, that was a beautiful segue.
You like that transition? Because I'm not going to let you go without talking about extended state DMT. I love the photo of you with all the wires in your head. You look like a kind of Kubrick film about some kind of dystopian psychedelic medicine experience. Yeah, so good.
Absolutely.
So in the bigger picture, you do a great job of weaving your social commentary and your ideas with your experience at Imperial College London, being under the influence of DMT for 40 minutes. And it's usually, for those who've experienced it, it's 10 minutes. And this was a quite audacious research study to mainline DMT for 40 minutes, which you signed up not to be the guinea pig, but to be the guinea pig of the guinea pigs.
That's right.
That's correct, right? You signed up to see if they got the dosing right. You were like the first line. That's awesome and terrifying. And the first thing that I was curious about is that you did about 50 ayahuasca ceremonies prior to doing this research. One of the reasons that you were able to do the research is they really wanted experienced psychonauts. You're talking about how they're extending DMT from 10 minutes to 40 minutes. When you're in an ayahuasca ceremony, aren't you essentially extending DMT from 10 minutes to 5 hours? How is mainlining DMT different than sitting in, say, an ayahuasca ceremony?
Yeah, it's a good question, because that is the closest experience to it. I would say there were a couple of differences. One is that obviously the Banisteriopsis caapi, the vine, was not in the mix. And that has harmaline, it's got its own chemical profile. And so I once in Peru worked with a shaman where we drank the vine and the leaf separately, which is a common practice as well. But we drank the vine and sat with it for quite a long time, like over an hour. And I could really feel the presence and the energy of that and the biochemistry of it, which, because it's an MAO inhibitor, possibly is the reason. Like, it felt almost MDMA-like, not quite, but it was a heavier kind of heart-opening kind of feeling. And then when we drank the leaf with the DMT-containing leaf, that experience came on within seconds, it felt like, extremely strong, launched into it. You know, it was a very powerful experience. DMT extended state was most similar to that, except without the biochemistry and presence of the vine. So experientially, I found it much cleaner, crisper. The teachings with ayahuasca I have found are incredibly beautiful and profound, and also have a kind of mysterious kind of element to them, where something might be a half truth that then manifests into something that, like, 6 months later, I'm like, oh my God, that was absolutely true. And, you know, it's winding and mysterious. I found the DMT extended state to be pretty direct, and it was like very sophisticated, clean teachings of, hey, let's look at this issue. This is how you show up in relationship. Let's look at it. Let's work with it. And so it also came on just like that, with the example I gave of separating the vine and the leaf. We were lying back on it like a bed, dentist chair, with one cannula, so like a, you know, permanent needle stuck in my left arm, which had the pump, the DMT pump, and in my right arm there was a medic taking blood every 2 minutes so they could compare the blood levels of DMT, and then covered in the EEG helmet, like 200 suckers on your head measuring your brain, and then an eye mask and headphones. And so you're in this like very sci-fi type experience. And when the DMT came in, it was instant. It was really like very, very strong. And it was very much like smoking DMT for those first 2 or 3 minutes. Then what happened for pretty much all of us, the first study is out by Lisa Luan, came out a couple months ago, so people can actually go in there and check it out. But our heart rates like really shot up. I think perhaps even doubled in those first few minutes. And then we all acclimatized to the experience. And then to go back to your original question, is it like an ayahuasca experience? Yeah, in a way, yes. I would say strong. I would say very, very strong. It's like being dropped into the most intense ayahuasca experience I've had for those kind of 40 minutes. But yeah, cleaner teaching. And it really gave me an appreciation of DMT as a healing and teaching experience, presence, molecule, however you want to define it, moving away from this idea of DMT being this sort of crazy metaphysical, like, what the hell is going on? And then suddenly it's over. That was what was different. I was able to be there longer and really get a sense of the depth of it.
So you have this great story about meeting the Spider Queen. And of course, everyone wants to know that story. I am not going to ask you about that story. Instead, I'm going to encourage our listeners to read your book. But I am going to talk to you about this idea of a teaching presence. You just alluded to DMT as an energy of teaching. I mean, the Spider Queen is a great story. But what I think is most helpful for our particular audience is to tell us a little bit about this teaching presence that seemed to be alive in these experiences, and in such a way as your personal biographical was also metaphysical. This kind of healing all seemed to weave together with this teaching presence. And I think if you can share with us a bit about this teaching presence, it might be instructive for those who would like to perhaps amplify this quality in people that they might be working with, or at least help people they're working with integrate some of the qualities of this teaching presence. So tell us a bit about the teaching presence you encountered.
Yeah, well, this is something that I experience on psychedelics. All psychedelics is some sense of I don't know quite how to describe it. Yeah, I call it teaching presence in the book. It's some sense of a teacher who is guiding and instructing me and helping me to go to different places in the experience. So there's my own agency. So I'm choosing to do stuff, but also I'm just listening and receiving these kind of teachings. Now, I think some people experience psychedelics like that and some people don't. And some people have a different relationship to the experience. We're all very different in how we process. So in my case, this is something that, you know, in shamanic traditions is talked about. You develop a relationship with that. For example, that's what I think is an important thing to bring to people into the experience, that if they do experience psychedelics in that way, then one really useful thing to remember is that it's like a student-teacher relationship. And in the same way, how do you be a good student? You're curious, you're listening, you're receptive. You also think for yourself, you know, just blindly do everything that's suggested. You have a relationship. And I think that sense of being in relationship to the experience, or being in relationship to the plant or the fungus or the DMT, is very important Because most of our wounds are relational, firstly, right? So it helps to kind of be relating in a new way. And also it makes it easier for me, at least. And I don't really have control over the fact that that's how I experience these. And probably other people who have that same experience, it's just how it shows up. But you can use that experience, or you can really decide how to show up in that experience. And it can really profoundly change the kind of the trip you have. There's times where in a psychedelic experience, let's say the psilocybin will be like, hey, let's look at this thing. This is also really important. You have to understand the different way different experiences teach. Psilocybin teaches differently to DMT, to ayahuasca. And for me, psilocybin is very playful, but also very direct, and can go from playful to very serious in a moment. And there are moments where it'll be like, I'll be having an experience, I'm really going into something, and it's saying, hey, you don't want to look at this, do you? This is the thing you don't want to look at. And sometimes I'll be like, I don't, I'm just fucking tired right now, I don't want to do any more work on myself. And it'll be like, okay, well, you know, it's here. So you get into this kind of playful, in that sense, it is kind of playful relationship. But what's crucial is I have an unbelievable amount of love and trust for that experience and that presence, because it has completely changed my life and taught me so much and literally made me the person I am. And so I really have this deep trust that if it's saying, hey, you need to look at this, I go, yeah, you know more than I do. I probably do need to look at that, even though I don't want to. But notice that it's not like a kind of, oh, it's the voice of God telling me I have to do something. It is a higher, you know, something of a higher awareness, but there is a relationship. I'm not just like, yes, yes, master, I'll do that. That's not a relationship. That's a broadcast from out on high. So I think that's the biggest lesson from that is that it is a relational process, and that really helps if we see it as such.
I like the delineation of the different vibes of these different plant teachers or fungi teachers or these different teachers. Actually, I think that would make a great topic for your Substack, is to give us an article, like a really like yummy, snacky kind of article of these different teacher vibes. I feel like that would do pretty well.
I love that. I'll definitely consider that for the mix. That's a cool idea.
And of course, that is the segue to the end of our conversation, which is when we talk about how people can learn more from you. And you have a Substack that people can digest, like the snack I just suggested, including such wonderful topics as The Ego Doesn't Die, Why Western Spirituality is So Confused, and What to Do About It. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that is like directly related to busting some myths that would be valuable for psychedelic healers. So the Substack is called The Bigger Picture. It's going to be in the show notes. Of course, The Bigger Picture is the name of your book as well, also in the show notes. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to be aware of in terms of how to connect with you or what you have upcoming that they might find interesting?
I've got a few things cooking away that aren't going to happen for a while. I'm doing a psychedelic super conference, which is happening in May. So I think the best thing to do is if people follow me on Instagram, which is just Alexander_Biner, then if you're interested in that or anything else I might be up to, that's probably the most up-to-date place.
Great. Well, we will have everything in the show notes, as it always is. If you've ever listened to any podcast ever, there's the guest info is in the show notes. So it's one of those things that we say again and again, but it is important, even if it is always the same. Ali, this is great, man. This is really nice chatting with you. And I always feel like I've had a great podcast when I feel like I've barely scratched the surface. And there's so much more that I think is helpful to our audience, not only in your book, which I definitely recommend, but also just in the work that you do, the stuff that you've done with Breaking Convention, the stuff that you did with Rebel Wisdom, which of course we didn't have time to pop into that today. So there's a lot of fun little nooks and crannies for our audience to explore. Congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the crazy Imperial College London study. I feel like I would have done that if my neighbor had approached me in a walkway and said, hey, do you want to be in a study? I would have said yes to. So
yeah, that's literally what happened. And yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been, as I expected, speaking with someone who just really knows this space inside out is really enjoyable. So yeah, I really appreciate it.
I like you lobbed a nice little compliment to me like right at the very end. It's nice. Classy. I got to go about my day. I'm good at knowing how to do my job. This is great. Thank you so much for being on the show. And yeah, I just look forward to seeing what comes next from you.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Our show is edited by Trevor Coulter of Velvet Honey Studios. Our graphics are by 1A Design. And our theme music is Source of Innovation by Skornik and Skornik. This show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks so much for listening.